From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We laugh at jokes because there's something we all get about them. They get repeated, they make the rounds, even among professional comedians. But the age of social media, Twitter and the rest, has raised sensitivity about authorship and ownership, about being copied, some say robbed. Now Twitter is blocking some jokes over copyright claims. Conan's being sued. It's messy out there. This hour on Point, who owns jokes in the social media age? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does the first one to tweet it own it? Who owns jokes? Anybody? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is David Sims, senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he covers culture. His recent article is Whose Joke Is It Anyway? You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. David Sims, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what is Twitter doing now? They're actually blocking jokes. What? Why?
It's even stranger than that in a way. If someone has tweeted a joke and then sees other people copy-pasting the joke and posting it themselves, and if they someone filed a copyright complaint, Twitter will go and just edit the other people's tweets and say this tweet is being withheld because it's in violation of a copyright complaint. So the tweet itself will actually change into a sort of a scarlet letter saying, this person might have stolen a joke.
So we're not talking retweeting, which would keep the original authorship visible, evident, intact. But if you copy and paste and steal, I guess Twitter won't recognize this, but if somebody raises the complaint.
Yeah, exactly. It's someone who had seen their very specific joke. I think it was a joke about someone spilling their juice on the sidewalk. So it was a personal anecdote. Someone saw that joke being taken by – it's usually by sort of robot accounts usually are just copy and pasting other people's popular tweets in an attempt to get some attention. She filed a DCMA complaint and Twitter actually complied. I think but what was new about it – this has been going on for a long time. You know, there are spam accounts that will steal someone's tweets. But it was for the first time Twitter actually was taking some action on it.
DCMA, the Digital Copyright Millennium Act.
I think that's right, yes.
Is that why? Is there new legislation that is pushing this? Or what's going on? Why is Twitter suddenly cracking down on copied jokes?
I'm not aware of any kind of legislative change or any sort of shift. I think it's just... It's probably just some sort of internal policy change at Twitter. You know, this is what's sort of interesting. Things will happen on Twitter with no real explanation. People just start noticing that the site has decided to start enforcing things, and sometimes that'll be they might ban someone's account if that person is being abusive. That happened a few months ago, and here it's they're finally recognizing that someone writes down a joke. You know, they have authorship over the material, and you're not allowed to just go ahead and take it.
Okay, there's the Twitter crackdown on copy and paste joke, theft, if you want to look at it.
I guess so, a verbatim copy.
We'll look more at the law on that. That's not the only social media effect, at least it's being asserted. We've got this spat going on, more than that, a legal dispute now between Robert Alex Caseberg and Conan O'Brien. Caseberg is saying that Conan O'Brien violated copyright on jokes that he posted on Twitter. I want to listen to some of these and see what you think, David. You've probably heard these, but go all the way back here first to January when Caseberg apparently posted on his personal blog. Here's the joke. A Delta flight this week took off from Cleveland to New York with just two passengers, and they fought over control of the armrest the entire flight. Here's Conan that same night.
On Monday, a Delta flight from Cleveland to New York took off with just two passengers. Two passengers on the whole plane. Yet somehow they spent the whole flight fighting over the armrest.
Caseberg says, wait a minute, here's another, February 17th. Caseberg writes, you know, the winter's been rough when a monument suffers shrinkage. That's about Washington Monument being 10 inches shorter than previously thought. Here's Conan's joke, same day.
Yesterday, surveyors announced that the Washington Monument is 10 inches shorter than what's been recorded. Yeah, of course, the monument's blaming the shrinkage on the cold weather.
Okay, hardy hard. David Sims, what about it? Social media makes everybody's ruminations or jokes immediately accessible. Does it make sense that Conan O'Brien's big squad of joke writers would be sitting in New York, scouring Twitter to rip off Robert Alex Caseberg?
Well, I mean, this is where it gets immediately very tricky because, I mean, we're talking about, I think in both cases there, you've got a current event, you know, there's some piece of news that's being picked up, which is, you know, the Conan monologue writers, that's their job to comb through every piece of news that they can think of any joke
right.
for. And then, you know, I mean, it is true the wording of the jokes is similar, but it unlike with the Twitter case where someone's obviously just literally copy and pasted a joke. Yeah, it's not too hard to imagine that two people might come to the same conclusion. You know, there's only so many dumb jokes we can make about a particular piece of current events.
I guess it's one thing to comb through the news and come up with a joke, and you can
right.
see how those might come down to the same thing. It's another if you're combing through the tweets to come up with a joke. David Sims with the Atlantic, please stand by in New York. Christopher Chris Sprigman joins us from New York as well. He's a professor at New York University Law School, author with... Cal Rostiala of The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Sparks Innovation. Chris Sprigman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
We need your legal view on this, law school professor. Listen to a couple more from this spat between Caseberg and Conan. February 3rd, Caseberg tweeted a joke about the Patriots Super Bowl win over the Seattle Seahawks. Here was his tweet. Tom Brady is going to give his MVP truck to the man who won the game for the Patriots. So enjoy that truck, Pete Carroll. Here's Conan, February 4th, next day.
Tom Brady says he wants to give the truck he was given as the Super Bowl MVP. They gave him a truck. He wants to give it to the guy who won the Super Bowl for the Patriots. I think it's very nice. I think that's nice. I do. Yeah, so Brady's giving his truck to Seahawks coach Pete Carroll.
Oh, sounds familiar, and it keeps going. Guess what'll race you here? June 9th, Robert Caseberg tweets, three streets named Bruce Jenner might have to change names. One could go from a cul-de-sac to a cul-de-sac-less. Conan, same day.
Some cities that have streets named after Bruce Jenner are trying to change the streets' names to Caitlyn Jenner.
Yeah!
Yeah. Yeah, and if you live on Bruce Jenner cul-de-sac, it will now be called a cul-de-sac. No sack.
Okay. Professor Sprigman, do we have a problem here in copyright terms?
So the difficulty in proving these copyright cases is exactly what your previous guest said, which is, did the Conan writers copy from this Californian stand-up comedian posting on Twitter? Or did the Conan writers come up with their own punchlines based on the same news events that were motivating the Californian tweeter? It's hard to tell, right? So what I'd be looking for if I were the judge in this case is whether, in fact, the Conan writers followed the plaintiff on Twitter. because these are jokes, the Washington Monument shrinkage joke, the airline armrest joke, that are pretty standard tropes. The kind of trope that you would imagine, the kind of punchline you'd imagine a lot of comedians looking at these news events at the same time would come up with. And there's precedent for this in the comedy world. So a few years ago, a pretty famous comedian named Joe Rogan got really incensed when he saw Carlos Mencia copying a joke from a friend of his, Ari Shaffer, a joke about building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. And the punchline was, well, who are we going to get to build that wall? Illegal Mexican day laborers, right? So it turns out that the wall between the U.S. and Mexico was much in the news at the time. And a bunch of comedians came up with that day laborer joke at about the same time. It was just their independent take on the news. Copyright does not protect authors against others who invent for themselves. It just protects against copying. So in the case of jokes, especially jokes that are sparked by something in the news, it's often hard to tell which is which.
But I wonder, Chris, if Twitter makes a difference. I mean, in the past, the jokes would make the rounds. You might hear somebody at a club. They might be on a television show. But on Twitter, you have all this volume happening all the time. You can see how Mr. Caseberg, and this is somebody who has... been a freelance writer, has done jokes for The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and more. You know, he puts it up on Twitter. It shows up on Conan that night. You can see how he might think, hey, wait a minute.
Sure, and this happens to comedians from time to time. They see jokes that sound a lot like their jokes, and they wonder where they came from. Were they copied, or were they jokes that the other person came up with independently? So that's always the question. I don't think Twitter really changes that. So for what it's worth, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's not like Twitter is doing anything special here. So Digital Millennium Copyright Act basically allows internet service providers like Twitter to avoid copyright liability if, when they receive notice that a copyright violation has occurred, they basically just take down the material that the notice points to. So someone on Twitter files a notice. Twitter has an agent. You send the notice to. It's electronic. It says, you know, take down this tweet because it's copyright violation. Twitter does a kind of minimal examination of the merits of that claim. They typically just want to get out of the way, so they take down the tweet. Now, importantly, they send a notice to the account holder of the tweet that was taken down saying, hey, if you don't think this is a copyright violation, let me know. So the account holder whose tweet has been taken down can file what's called a counter notification, at which point Twitter will put the tweet back up without any risk of liability to Twitter. And then, you know, the copyist or the alleged copyist and the person who thinks he or she was copied from will maybe fight it out in court, maybe. But unlikely, because I can tell you that, you know, there's been virtually no litigation ever over stolen jokes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who owns jokes, particular expressions of humor. In the age of social media and Twitter and all the rest, it's so easy to copy and paste. It's become an issue. Twitter blocking now on copyright challenges. Jokes online, a suit against Conan O'Brien from a joke writer in San Diego who says, wait a minute, I tweeted that, and the next thing I know, you're saying it on air. David Sims is with us from The Atlantic. Chris Sprigman with us, co-author of The Knockoff Economy, with us from New York University School of Law. And yes, it all predates Twitter. Back in March 2004, comedian Ari Shaffir performed stand-up at the Latino Laugh Festival, joked about building a wall on the Mexican border. We heard mention of that. Carlos Mencia later accused of stealing the joke. But here's Ari Shaffir.
Here's this new thing, I don't know if you guys heard this. He wants to build a new wall all down the California-Mexico border, like a 12-foot-high brick wall. It's like 3 feet deep, so no Mexicans get in. But I'm like, dude, Arnold, who do you think is going to build that?
Okay, and then here's Carlos Mencia, Comedy Central, 2006.
You know what they said in California? I saw it on C-SPAN. People we vote for. This is what they said. I propose that we kick all the illegal aliens out of this country. Then we build a super fence so they can't get back in. And I went, who's going to build it?
Okay, Carlos Mencia, he took a lot of heat on that. This is not a new thing in comedy. Is it different because of social media? David Sims, Chris Sprigman, stand by. Alex is calling from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Alex, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I think that it's really crazy that posting something on Twitter should imply a copyright. Anything out on the internet is in the public domain, and jokes have been folklore anyway. As long as they've been jokes, they're just public folklore. I'm not a Twitter user myself, but a similar situation I became aware of a few years ago when I was listening to the Moth Radio Hour,
okay,
which I think is supposed to be people telling stories of their own lives.
Yep.
And somebody was relating a story about a series of auto accidents that they had one day, and as he was telling the story, it was like going on for 10 minutes, I was recognizing the events. And I suddenly said, wait a minute, this is a joke. I've heard a comedian do this whole joke, and I knew the punchline before that guy got to it. And the audience laughed as if, you know, well, it was funny, but were people thinking this actually happened to that person on the Moth Radio Hour? It was just a joke that I had heard before.
So lighten up, people. It's folklore. It moves around. I appreciate your call so much, Alex. Chris, help us with the law here. Alex looked at this and says, does a tweet imply a copyright?
So, strangely, it does, in the sense that any creative expression fixed in a tangible medium, so Twitter is a tangible medium, believe it or not, because it's stored in computer memory. Any creative expression fixed in a tangible medium is copyrightable. You don't have to register it to get a copyright. You don't have to give notice to people of the copyright. We've driven all those requirements out of the law. I think that was a bad idea, but that's another discussion. So, yeah, even trivial things like this are copyrightable. Now, the question, though, is, you know, how enforceable is it? So let me just tell you a little bit about the history of comedy, which I think helps answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
So my colleague Dotan Oliar and I spent a couple of years kind of living in the comedic world, talking to comedians, watching what they do, interviewing them about this subject. And it turns out that the history is something like this. So from the birth of stand-up comedy just after the fall of the vaudeville era, until about the mid-1960s, jokes were essentially viewed as public property. So comedians wrote jokes, they bought jokes, they stole jokes. They did all this stuff without any shame. There was really no norm against joke stealing. In the mid-60s, that began to change, and it began to change in part because comedy began to change from the kind of one-liner era of roughly interchangeable jokes to an era where comedy became much more personalized, it became much more exploratory. And at the same time, this norm against joke stealing grew up. Now, this is not to say that comedians have ever resorted to lawsuits, because they don't. At least they don't sue one another. There have been a couple of lawsuits against book publishers, t-shirt manufacturers, but not comedian versus comedian for joke stealing. What they do is they actually resort to norms. So the comedians, their community watches out for joke stealing, and they retaliate against it. They badmouth joke stealers. They refuse to work with them. Occasionally, they punch them in the mouth. And this informal system, which isn't really law but is law-like, disciplines joke stealing. It keeps joke stealing in control enough that comedians have the incentive to go on with their work.
A pop in the chops versus going to the law. That's happening in the social media age. Jerry in South Miami, Florida. Jerry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm old enough to remember that Milton Berle was famous for telling other people's jokes.
Yes, he was.
And I tell jokes all the time, but I don't use Twitter. I do tell them on the telephone. And I think this whole thing's a bunch of nonsense. People are always using other people's jokes, and most of them are variations of jokes that have been told before for decades or years.
But, of course, people get pretty upset about it sometimes. If it's typed onto Twitter and immediately broadcast to the whole world with somebody else's name on it, does that make a difference to you, Jerry?
No, not really.
let it roll. David Sims, Tempest in a Teapot, that people have always repeated jokes, so why complain now?
Yeah, there is some weight to that argument. I think what Chris was saying to make that this has always been an internal thing, especially when comedy was much more of a something that germinated in clubs and comedy clubs, where comedians would be watching each other's acts and following each other on stage. Stealing someone's joke is very uncool and could be sort of spotted and enforced in all those sort of informal ways that we were talking about very easily. But now that it's on the internet, it's a much more nebulous idea. And of course, you know, there's not too much harm being done, especially, you know, if, let's say, someone, you know, just saw someone's joke on Twitter and it inspired them to write sort of the same joke. But it's when money starts to be made, I suppose, is when people start to really make a fuss about this stuff. And obviously, a comedian's whole purpose of a comedian is his originality, especially in an era when there are so many comedians that you can find on the internet. There's so many specials you can watch on the internet, things like that. A comedian really wants to maintain control of his originality.
Of course, what is the originality? I mean, I'm looking here at the copyright law, Chris, and it says the copyright law defends the expression of an idea, not the idea itself.
What
does originality mean in comedy?
Well, this is one of the ways in which copyright law doesn't fit comedy very well. So copyright law protects original expression, but it does not protect ideas, including comedic ideas. So that joke about the Washington Monument's shrinkage, so the idea basically underlying that is that the Washington Monument is like a gigantic penis. I'm sure some people have thought of that from time to time. You know, there's a shrinkage joke kind of waiting to be told. So copyright doesn't protect that idea. It might protect the particular way in which the idea is expressed. But often, if you want to copy the comedic idea behind a joke, which is really what often makes it valuable, you can just express it a little bit differently and escape copyright liability. It's always been that way, and this is one of the reasons why comedians don't really resort to copyright, or haven't historically. It's just not very promising for them. It's just better for them. It works better if they exercise their own norms within their community and discipline joke stealers through these informal means, which is what they've done. Now, one thing that's maybe new here is that Twitter has kind of been dropped into the comedic community, mm-hmm. that there's a lot of comedians sitting around all day kind of reacting to the news on Twitter. Sometimes this is how they write jokes. Sometimes this is how they test out jokes. And there's some copying going on, and you know, people are getting bent out of shape, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. The thing that seems interesting to me here, and what makes this actually a little bit silly, is that the copying is going on by spam bots. It's spam bots that are actually copying. Robots don't care that it's your joke, and robots also don't care if you send a takedown notice.
Spam bots, and these are the little code packages that go around, what, just sucking up popular tweets and re-delivering them under their own
handle. That's what a spam bot does on Twitter. And, mm-hmm. you know, the fact is that spam bots can't be disciplined through the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You know, you shut down a spam bot account, it just pops up somewhere else under another name. So this is all a bit of a game of whack-a-mole and kind of a huge waste of time.
Maybe just a natural outgrowth of the tech era we're in. But we know feelings run deep about this. Louis C.K. and Dane Cook had a famous kind of grudge match over this. Let's listen back to remember what part of what got that going. This is an HBO special, 2005. Louis C.K. performed a joke about naming his kids. Listen to this, then we'll hear Dane Cook.
40Fs, that's his name. Go clean your room. Some people name their kids a word like sunshine or battery or whatever. I like to name my kid a whole phrase, you know, something like ladies and gentlemen. That would be a cool name for a kid. This is my son, ladies and gentlemen.
My child, ladies and gentlemen, are 40 Fs. Here's Dane Cook, same year. Begins saying he wants to name his child a bunch of R's.
Time for bed. I said time for bed. No cookies. Typical. Daddy's on the phone. Daddy's on the phone. I'm going to name a group of my kids after my favorite cartoon. I'm going to name a bunch of them after Transformers. That'd be great. Oh, yeah. Just to be like, Optimus Prime, come here for a second. I want to talk to you.
Dane Cook and Louis C.K. in 2005, Memory is Long. Here was season two of Louis, 2011. Dane Cook confronted Louis C.K. on the show about those accusations of stealing Louis C.K.'s jokes.
2006. That should have been like my triumph. And I enjoyed it, Louis, for maybe 2 months. 2 months before it started to suck. Because everything I read about me was about how I stole jokes from you, which I didn't.
I kind of think you did.
Dude, why would I steal 3 jokes from you when I have hours of material? Why? Why would I do that? Risk my reputation?
Because they were funny jokes.
Not forgiven. Not right there, anyway. We're looking at jokes in the age of social media. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Dane Cook and Louis C.K. Benjamin in New Orleans, what are you hearing, Benjamin? What are you seeing on Twitter? What are you thinking about here?
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think that social media is a great way for artists to stay in touch with one another and observe, you know, kind of the temperature of the zeitgeist or what have you. But I also think there's a certain amount of honor that needs to be observed, that while being inspired by someone's work is certainly a great thing, if you want to directly sample that person's work in such a way that directly resembles the source, you need to give credit where credit is due.
So give the credit. Even if you only have 140 characters to give the joke and the credit, Benjamin, let us pick it up. Jesse David Fox joins us from New York, senior editor at Vulture. He's been thinking and writing about this whole latest spat over humor and social media as well. Jesse David Fox, thank you for joining us. What do you make of this? Benjamin says at least give credit in a tweet.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I think the hope is that you give credit, but you know, the internet has been trading jokes around. I think when we think of written jokes, and as comedians do, you're like, oh, they should give credit. But if you think about, like, visual memes, if someone makes a funny GIF or a Photoshop, that just gets spread around, and whoever started it gets lost. I think what happened, there's a recent example where the Fat Jewish, who was a popular Instagram figure,
okay,
was accused of joke stealing, where he'd specifically take people's jokes, then type them out in his notes, and then just Instagram them. And then after being accused, he now, in his comment on the joke, he'll put the name of the person's Twitter account who did it. I think that's probably your best-case scenario, but, you know, the internet, you know, the next person who shares it isn't going to put that person's name, and then the next person that shares it isn't going to put that person's name. So then in 4 weeks, that joke is going to completely lose who wrote it.
But isn't that the way jokes have always spread out like ripples in a pond?
Yeah, I think the person who said it before, it's like folklore. A joke, especially a joke that's evergreen, ultimately is going to completely lose whoever said it. And, you know, I mean, a joke often is about to, like, say a thing that we've all been thinking. So if we've all been thinking it, a joke is essentially the best way of phrasing a thing that we've all wanted to talk about. So as a result, there's kind of a need for a lot of those jokes, especially in that sense, which is a little bit different than comedians stealing from each other. But in terms of the internet, you totally can see why things spread, and you just kind of have to accept that that's what it does.
What about Alex Caseberg out in California? Wrote for Jay Leno, maybe others, put some tweets out, thinks he hears exactly those jokes on Conan within hours or days, says, hey, lawsuit, hundreds of thousands of dollars, please.
Yeah, that's not the case. I think there's no way that the Conan writers, in their very busy day of writing monologue jokes, like trolled around Twitter and hoping someone had a better obvious punchline about the Washington Monument. It's the difference with Twitter is, you know, for years, people would think of their own monologue-type jokes and then just say it to a friend, and then they'd show up on Johnny Carson, and they'll be like, oh, that's like that joke I thought of. But no one assumed Johnny Carson was, like, tapping their phones. The difference is now you can see it on Twitter. You know, there's only so many obvious punchlines to, you know, monologue jokes, which is on purpose supposed to be, you know, pretty obvious. You know, they're doing 10 jokes a night, 5 nights a week, 200 shows a year, whatever. That's, you know, we're talking about thousands of jokes. There's going to be overlap.
So David Sims, maybe Twitter is just showing us how much we all think along the same lines, however original we think we may be.
I mean, that's very true. I mean, the funniest thing about the Washington Monument joke, obviously, is that, you know, everyone knows shrinkage. Everyone probably thinks of Seinfeld as the sort of source material for any kind of shrinkage joke. So you've got, you know, you got one guy saying basically, well, they ripped off my Seinfeld reference. and you know, at a certain point, yeah, we're all drawing from the same limited pool of information, especially when it comes to pop culture or breaking news.
And yet, Chris, people want to, they want credit when they feel like they've broken through and found something fresh, their own.
Yeah, but I think writing a decent Washington Monument shrinkage joke is not the same as inventing a new drug to cure cancer. Okay, it's a much more trivial act of originality. And the truth is, if you put 10 comedians in 10 cubicles and presented them with that article about the Washington Monument actually being shorter than everyone expected, I bet you know, 7 of them would arrive at the shrinkage joke. So I don't think any of this is all that surprising. I imagine the plaintiff in this case against Conan is going to have an uphill battle showing that the Conan writers copied rather than simply getting those jokes on his own. People want credit, and they also, I hate to say to a certain extent, tend to overestimate their own originality. You know, there are very few jokes, very few things in general that are truly new under the sun, and I think Twitter's making that pretty visible.
Social media cranking it all up. David Sims with The Atlantic wrote, "Whose joke is it anyway?" Thanks so much for being with us from New York today, David.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who owns jokes in the age of social media and Twitter and people borrowing, copying, stealing from all over. Chris Sprigman is with us, co-author of The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Sparks Innovation, pays a lot of attention there to comedy and the long history of kind of what rough and tumble policing of themselves that comedians did. Now lots of people are in on it. Joins us from New York and New York University School of Law. Chris is there, Jesse David Fox in New York as well, senior editor at Vulture. Gary Gulman joins us in a moment, stand-up comedian. Lots of response online. We asked, who do you think is funny on Twitter? Check out our at On Point Radio Twitter feed to see people's suggestions there. At Honest Toddler, at Tween Hobo, and right on down. Do they copy and paste? Well, I guess we'll find out. Here we've got people talking about Milton Berle, who was famous for stealing jokes. DB reminds us, Milton Berle himself once said, "I laughed so hard I broke my pencil point," i.e., he was writing while they were joking. Alvaro says a big part of the joke is the delivery, and Conan is best at that, wherever it came from. People remember for a long time, this is season 40 of Saturday Night Live, aired this year. Louis C.K. there, confronted by comedian Bruce Chandling, played by Kyle Mooney. This time, Bruce accuses Louis of stealing his act.
Hey, listen, Louis, we gotta talk. You stole my act.
What?
I'm talking about the family stuff. Living in this day and age, people getting mad, being in a house.
Being in a house? What is it you think I stole from you?
I mean, where do I begin? You know, you took that bit where I go, you know, paying the rent ain't easy. That's why I don't do it.
I would never say anything like that, so I think we're cool.
Here we go.
You can hear just how broad the themes can be. You stole my themes. They're about life. It's happened. In 2010, Marc Maron interviewed Robin Williams on his WTF podcast. And in that interview, Williams spoke about how early in his career he said, accidentally steal jokes.
If you hang out in comedy clubs, when I was doing almost 24/7, you hear things, and then if you're improvising, you all of a sudden you repeat it, going, "Oh,
right, that's the way your brain works."
My brain was working that way. Now I literally had to go through a period and went, "I'm not going to hang out anymore. I can't, because I don't want to get into that thing."
Don't even get too close to it. David in Norfolk, Virginia. Thank you for calling, David. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I want to disagree with the guy who said that probably Conan's writers aren't trolling the internet. We had a similar experience happen to us before social media. In 2005, we went to New York for we launched our humorous greeting card line.
Okay.
And we had a number of people stop by. One was, talk to this guy. He is a freelance writer for a late night show. And we even talked to him about hiring him to do some comedy writing for our line. Probably a couple of weeks go by, and one of the jokes from one of our greeting cards appears on this late night show that he told us he wrote for. I quite honestly think that, you know, when you're writing jokes is not an easy thing, and especially for a late night show to do it on such a consistent basis. You have writer's block, you need to perform. You know, that temptation is there to kind of troll the internet to kind of do that. And I think this guy was kind of in a similar situation. He wasn't employed full time. And, you know, I admit that this somebody else at the show could have come up with this independently, but it's so similar.
So you're skeptical that it's also clean hands. David, I appreciate your call. Jesse David Fox. Chris had his humorous greeting cards ripped off, he thinks, on late night. So why not Twitter?
Well, first, I would have to know the exact greeting card. I think it's a matter of, like, well, that's a very clear example of a writer who wasn't directly employed might have very explicitly stole it, or an example like what Robin Williams, which it went in his head, and then he thought he thought of it. It just, you know, a lot of one, a lot of monologue joke writers are not particularly tech savvy. They tend to be older than the regular staff. And it just seems so unlikely that this is how they would do it. It just, like, what would they be searching? They'd just be searching Washington Monument. I think for a person whose job is to write monologue jokes, there isn't writer's block. It isn't hard. It is just as easy as your job is for you. It's hard to think that way, but
if you do, there you are.
Yeah, I mean, if you can write jokes, that's how you, it's just like how you can write. I can write sentences, or how anyone can do it. It's just like to them, that's a language that they speak in, especially monologue writing, which is essentially as close as a math formula as you're going to get. You know, they have their input, and then they bounce it around their brain, and then next thing you know, they have this joke. And if you have the same input with a lot of people who have that sort of outlook, then you're going to have it. You'll see. You know, the New Yorker does that, the caption contest, and I think I heard that half the entries are exactly the same, and they have to just basically throw out all of those. You know, it happens a lot. Parallel thinking is incredibly likely, though I think this guy's greeting card example might be a freelance writer who just trying to get an in might have stolen something. But that is
maybe the low end of the food chain, otherwise water all flows downhill, maybe to the same place. Ellen, Charleston, South Carolina. Ellen, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick comment about that parallel thinking and how we all think we're more original than we are.
Yeah,
I have webbed toes.
Okay.
And when people find out I have webbed toes, 95% of people think they're really clever and say something about how I can swim faster or I'm like a duck. And they all just think it's the most original thing they've ever come up with. And it's so funny and are always surprised when I kind of go, oh, okay, and don't laugh at their joke that
I've heard
about 400 times now.
Ellen, with your lovely web toes, we'll make no joke about that, though we're very tempted, and I can see what you mean by parallel thinking. I appreciate your call, Ellen. Thank you. Ted in Madison, Connecticut. Ted, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. My comment was relates to something that one of your prior callers said, that the notion that the internet is public domain, and it certainly relates to comic like we're talking about, but I think it also relates to photography and writing and things that's not the case. And there are many people whose livelihoods and their value are tied up in creation. And if it's out on the internet, it's not public domain and it's not free access for everyone. And I'll take comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. Chris, this seems to be in your wheelhouse. What's public domain and what not? What difference does it make, let's say, when you get to a forum like Facebook or Twitter?
Yeah, so this comment about whether things on the internet are in the public domain or not is a great example of the clash between law, on the one hand, and mm-hmm. norms. Okay, so the law says that jokes can be copyrighted, and just because they're on the internet doesn't mean they lose that copyright. The law says that photographs are copyrightable, and just because they're on the internet doesn't mean they lose it. But people's norms are something different, and what people, I think, expect when they see photographs on the internet, or not all people, but a significant chunk of people, is that these are available for use. If I right-click on this and copy it to my desktop and then use it in a Facebook post, this is not a big deal. It's not a copyright violation. The same with jokes. If I spread around a joke, that's not a copyright violation. So what's going to win, law or norms, right? Is the technology going to drive reality, or is the law going to drive reality? I mean, I put my bet very heavily on the technology and the norms and not the law, because I think copyright law, in a lot of respects, has failed. So the music industry came up against peer-to-peer file sharing, and the music industry recruited copyright law to squash peer-to-peer file sharing, and that, we all know, was a complete disaster, right? So recorded music revenues are down, adjusted for inflation, about 60% since Napster first appeared.
Yep.
And copyright law couldn't really do anything about that, right? The technology drove the music industry very unwillingly in another direction. That direction turns out to be streaming, right? So streaming revenues are up. The copyright the music industry has figured out a way to survive in this kind of post-copyright landscape, but copyright law turns out to be somewhat of a toothless law.
So it's public domain or it's not?
Well, it depends on what perspective you take. I mean, if you're a lawyer like me, you say, well, no. I mean, the law says it's not.
if you're just a person living in the world,
yeah.
you might take a different perspective. So if you're just describing the way people act,
yeah.
okay, so Richard Prince recently, the famous appropriation artist, took a bunch of Instagram posts, appended a comment to them, printed them out on an inkjet printer, showed them at the Frieze Art Fair in New York, and sold them for $90,000 a piece. Right now, the law maybe says that he can't, but he did, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a furor over that, and the furor is about whether authorship and copyright should be our baseline, or whether, you know, freedom of expression and the internet should be our baseline. You know, you can say that's a good debate or a bad debate, but that's the debate. And I think, in broad strokes, mm-hmm. that norms of the internet are winning out over law.
Maybe we are in a new day. Let's hear from a comedian. Gary Gulman joins us in about 31 seconds. But first, here's one of his jokes performed on Conan, no less, in 2014, joking about the different generations, expectations, and OJ.
My parents are from the greatest generation. They're amazing. They survived World War II, the Great Depression, the polio epidemic, pulp in their orange juice. Unregulated, unlimited pulp in their orange juice. Never said a word about it. Never complained. Then wheat came along, took one sip. What was that? There's orange in my orange juice.
Gary Gulman on Conan in 2014. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gary Gulman joins us now from New York. Stand-up comedian with us at this moment. Gary, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I adore you. I'm a big fan.
What do you make of all the ruckus over Twitter and who originates what and what joke ends up where? When you go on Conan, do you think his guys are trolling Twitter for jokes for that night?
No. I mean, the thing is that these topical jokes are, the setups are the same for everyone. They all have the same setups. They're going to the same newspapers or the same websites. They're all getting the same setups, and there's only so many places you can go with the punchline. And the shrinkage, I mean, to me, it's too, they're fighting over a very weak joke, if you ask me. I mean, it's also a rip from Seinfeld. So I it's not a joke that I would want my name on.
So so we hear you here joking about orange juice and expectations and generations. If you saw a condensed version of that on Twitter tomorrow, would you be upset as a comedian?
I would be upset, but I've learned to accept it because it's funny because there was actually an episode of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee where Jerry Seinfeld mentions the different levels of pulp, and which I had done in 2014, and it's yeah. this season, and I thought, my fear is that everybody's going to think I stole it from him. So it's frustrating and it's upsetting, but I don't think for a second that Jerry Seinfeld saw my Conan and then decided to do something on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. I mean, the pulp levels in the orange juice is an absurd thing that everybody is aware of, and Seinfeld's particularly incisive, so I'm just surprised he didn't come up with it sooner. But I will say, before I did anything about that, I went on the internet, and a lot of us will ask each other, hey, have you seen anybody do anything about this? Do you do anything about this? Guys like Jim Gaffigan and David Tell will call me and say, do you have anything on this? So we're self-policing, but it's also, I sometimes blame the audiences because the audiences are not as savvy as us. They haven't seen as many jokes, and so they'll still laugh at the airplane food joke or the fact that the airplane seat doesn't go back very far. Audiences will still laugh at that, and so comedians will still do it. So it's just a matter of comedians being harder on themselves as far as originality goes. I mean, to me, my prime directive is originality, and while you can't, I guess you can't shepherdize a joke like you would with a law precedent. You can go on the internet and you can ask around and see if anybody else is doing something similar. And the nature of topical material is you're going up against what, 6 late night shows and all their writers. Do you really think you're going to come up with something more interesting than that? I mean, I seldom tweet anything topical. The last topical thing I tweeted that Sheldon Adelson was the worst thing to happen to Jews since bacon bits. And But I wrote that down in the internet and see if anybody had done that before. Nobody had, so I tweeted it out. But it's just, I don't think that these are major jokes to be fighting.
Gary, I must say, it sounds very onerous, Gary, to have to go and scour the internet as a stand-up comedian like yourself before you feel free to deliver a joke. I mean, that as convenient as the internet is, that's still a lot of work.
Yeah, and it might be paranoia, and maybe I'm just, but as your guest said, there's it's very difficult to be original, and if that's your idea of what's important in comedy or art in general, then these are the things you have to do. I mean, I just don't want to be the comedian who's doing something that they say, oh, this one, everybody has a joke on say that, I always say airplane, but there are other things. The Kardashians are, you know, there was a joke that the guy was fighting over about Caitlyn Jenner, and it's just like these are innuendo jokes about sex and penises, and I just think the audience should be tired of those by now anyhow. So I don't. To me, the level of joke they're fighting for is beneath them.
Yeah, Jesse, Chris, come in.
Tom, I just want to say something about what I'm hearing here, which is, you know, what I've heard from a lot of comedians. So you want to be original. That's the real currency in the comedic community. And, yeah, it's onerous to go searching the internet to see if another comedian has done a joke before you tweet out a joke. But, you know, I hear in what the comedian is saying here, this norm system at work, right? So comedians want to have the regard of their peers, and being original is the way to get it. Being a hack is the way to lose it. So, you know, this shows the power, I think, of comedians' expectations for themselves and their own community.
Gary, what do you think? Just 20 seconds here. Is it good for you, ultimately, Twitter, source of jokes, or joke about it?
I just think that the idea of having to look up to see if somebody else did it is going to push the art form further and make it more original and more insightful in it, and I think it'll grow that way. Twitter, I don't care.
Gary Gulman doesn't care. Bigger than Twitter, bigger than Facebook, bigger than the web. Gary Gulman, it's great. You're very kind to come with us on and be with us for a minute here. Thanks so much for joining us today. Hey, honor to have you, Gary. Thanks so much, stand-up comedian Gary Gulman with us from New York. Jesse David Fox in New York as well, senior editor at Vulture. What an interesting hour. Thank you so much for your input, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
And Chris Sprigman at New York University School of Law, co-author of The Knockoff Economy. Some knockoffs here, but not only knockoffs. Chris, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.